The podcast that you're about to hear comes from a program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. These sessions have been facilitated by Christian Teusner from the Emu Tree in partnership with the Wakery RSL sub-branch. To explore further podcasts, visit thewaywewere.podbean.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening. I'm here with Clem McArdle. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to me today, Clem. Could you start by stating your full name and your date of birth, please?
Clement Paul McArdle, born at Murray Bridge, 24th March 1923. 98.
How are you feeling? All good?
Yeah, feeling good.
That's terrific. Well,
I've been very lucky with my health up to now.
You look well, Clem. Yeah, you look really well, you do.
So they don't have to worry about me too much.
Could I ask you, Clem, please, to just tell me a little bit about, you mentioned you were born in Murray Bridge. Could you tell me a little bit about your childhood, you know, the early memories of your childhood, perhaps?
I was the youngest of five boys, and I went to school at a place called Kermanduk, and that was the only schooling I had.
Okay.
Was at Kermanduk.
And was it, how many students were at the school? Was it a very
small
group?
There was only about 10 or 12 at a time, and strangely enough, there was only one girl for a certain time.
What do you remember about those days? What was it like?
It was quite good, but the times were pretty hard, generally speaking, on account of the way of life. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the schooling, and after school, I didn't do any particularly work, only on the farm. My father had a farm, and he was also the clerk and overseer of the District Council of Peak, with his office in the farmhouse. And one of my brothers had an agency, a grain agency, and I did quite a bit of work for him.
Could you tell me a little bit about your father? You mentioned he was a farmer. What was your father's name?
Norman Reginald Bruce. He had three names. Norman Reginald Bruce McArdle, well known person in the district. He carried on his the work until about 1960, when he retired. He had a stroke just before he retired, and I carried on the work in the office for him until the health improved.
And what year, roughly what period was this?
Would have been in the 50s, about 1954 approximately. I got married later on. I married the local school teacher. In those days, the education department would not allow women to be teachers if they were married, and eventually that was abolished. But to make an amusing part, I had to pay £8 to get her, Viola Hilda McArdle. Her name was Lewis before. She was an organist, and of course there's other things developed once we were married. I played the drums, and she played the piano for local dancers.
And how often would you play? How often would you perform?
Fairly often, because her mother was living with us and was able to look after children. We had six children, and we went different places and played.
And how far would you travel to perform?
Oh, up to 20, 30 miles, yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, Meningi, Canalpin, Sherlock.
Can I ask you, Clem, who inspired you to play drums, to learn drums?
Well, there was a man who used to work for my father doing odd jobs, man of all trades, and he could play the drums, and I was a bit keen on doing it, and he gave me a few lessons. And on the railways in those days, they had signalmen, you know, two people, one on, one off. And one was, this particular chap played the saxophone, he was an Estonian, from Estonia.
Yes.
Very frightened of the communistic party, looking over the shoulder sort of thing, because he was frightened about his father and mother back in Estonia for the commerce. And anyway, he played with us, and it was quite good.
Good memories?
Yeah, it was good memories.
I'm really pressing this, Clem, but...
That's all right.
Can you recall any of the songs that you used to perform?
Oh, yeah, well, as a matter of fact, we performed in a... or tried to perform in an amateur hour. They used to have a lot of amateur hours in those days, different places. And Harry Sarr, this man's name was... S-A-A-R-E, I think it was, Sarah. And we decided to perform with this amateur hour. And it was, the song was The Golden Wedding, which was a predominant instrument needed for that, you know, with the drums. Anyway, we were halfway through and he lost his part. And poor old Harry was quite upset. And once you lose a part in Golden Wedding, anyway, he lost his part and it ruined it somewhat.
What brand of drum kit did you use?
Oh, well, it was only a cheap one. My father saw it advertised in the paper, and it was from he drove me up to Wallaroo to get it. Mm. It was a second-hand set, and he paid £15 for it, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and I never ever got a real good one, but the war came. And my brothers had trucks, tip trucks, earth for earth moving. My two of my brothers, and the highways department got together a lot of equipment to go up onto the road between. Burdham and Catherine. Now, the end of Burdham was the old railway. The convoys on the road was being travelled quite a lot by the Americans and Australians. Mm-hmm. And naturally, the road wasn't very, very good. It was only windy track through the scrub, and however, on the way up with the convoys, I was detailed by my brothers to drive one of the trucks. So my eldest brother Bruce was going to go up on one truck, and I'd go on another truck, a tip truck. Because The government was calling for trucks and things and drivers to work on this particular road. Now, the road was a lot of sections for the various states. South Australia, we had Burnham to Katherine, and the New South Wales doing the bridges, Queensland were doing up Tennant Creek End up through there, and to get the bitumen on the road at the finish was done by Victoria, and they were doing 6 miles per day bitumen. Once we formed the road up in the other states, got everything ready, they would come along. My truck broke down, and Bruce, my brother's truck, his broke down. They were the trucks were hired for £5 a week, I think it was, which is a fair bit of money in those days. This is back in 1942 up there. Yeah. £5 a week, and for every hour that they worked was £2, plus the driver's wages, which was paid by the highways. So that was £5, £2, and the wages for the drivers, and that's what they were hired under, you see, and. And then the Japs bombed Darwin Airport and put it out of action. Our convoy, which was set up for road making and everything, the story was that we were slowed down to do the Daly Waters airfield to take on the American and Australian aircraft. Mm-hmm. And my truck, I was still working on that then, and Brother Bruce was too. And of course, to extend the airfield, they had to widen it and lengthen it, and to improve it, to operate the heavy aircraft, mm-hmm. such as Flying Fortresses and. They had Dauntless dive bombers, and Australia had their Hudson bombers. They were parked along the road, camouflaged in the scrub. We were there for about 6 weeks.
Can I ask you, how did you feel at this time? Do you remember how you felt? Were you being up there so far up north?
Very nervous. I felt a bit homesick at times. I tell you what made me a bit nervous was coming on the airfield with a load of soil, with the duty pilot tower and binoculars. That's all they had there, because they didn't have the equipment like they had at the Darwin Airport when they were there. And I was coming in with a load of soil one day, you know, before the pilot chair, duty pilot could see the planes coming, was a long way off, and the siren took place, and therefore all the machinery and everything was removed from the airfield, and I came onto the airfield and I looked around. There was no one about. I thought, gee, what's going on? I, not knowing that it was our aircraft or American, so I didn't know what to do. So I got out of the vehicle and squatted down behind the vehicle and looked up, and to my great relief, There was the Bullseyes and the Star, you know. The it was a little bit nerve-wracking.
You said you were up there for 6 weeks. Was there any other situations that you recall that stand out?
Well, there was when it came time for us to leave the that job and carry on, one of the graders they had broken down, and for some reason or other they wanted to take it forward. My truck had broken down at that point or near. They got me to steer the thing while we travelled about 200 to 300 miles on doing about 4 miles an hour. Oh, God. That was very monotonous because of all the convoys and things were going past, dust was flying, and it was a bit debilitating. We got there while all this work was going on. They had a couple of semi-trailers running backwards and forwards from the work to Alice Springs, supplies and things that were needed for the road gang. We had surveyors and another one, and they had a big cable from one tractor to another and going along. Behind that was two little, what we used to call Buckeye bulldozers with a blade only about 6 foot long, and that was to push the stuff aside. Of course, by that time I was relegated to being a labourer, you see, because my truck had broken down. However, and then they decided to have night work to do all this work at night. My eldest brother, he was a mechanic, very good one too, and he used to be in charge of the lights. Where we got the gravel from, they used to have floodlights.
Mm-hmm. So you were 19 years of age. You were 19, 20 years of age,
yes,
at this point.
That's right. That, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like incredibly hard work.
Yeah, it was, but you know, I didn't mind it. You know, we were all there together and working as a team, and we knew what we were there for, and we thought of it a lot. Yeah. And my eldest brother had a radio, the shortwave radio. We could listen to a lot of the things that were going on the rest of the world. And I was going to say about this night work, I was taken off the labourer's job to drive somebody else's truck. See, well, they had to find extra drivers to take over the ordinary ones that were already there. I think it's rather amusing that the wages I was getting might make you smile. It was three and a penny and 4/11 of a penny per hour. Now I repeat, 3 and a penny and 4/11. Now how they got the 4/11, I'll never know.
How many hours a day were you working?
It was 11 hours a day, but a lot of there were some people were packing up on the long hours, and they cut it down to about 10, I think.
When you were not on shift, whereabouts would you recuperate and rest?
The camps were about every 7 or 8 miles along the road. See, the material we were using was very, very good material. It was very plentiful on the side of the road. And of course, they used to shift the Chinaman. They had to put the Chinaman on a semi-trailer to take it forward to the next site, you see, so on.
Mm-hmm.
And the material was strange, as it may seem. It was like hundreds and thousands of lollies, you know, with it bulldozed. And it'll go as hard as that table. Very, very solid. To do the aircraft, to make mess huts and things on the way, to put a floor in the mess huts, they used ant hills. And when the ant hills were crushed up, they were as hard as concrete.
And there was plenty of them?
Plenty of ant hills around. They were all pointing north and south. This is all before I went in the Air Force, of course.
Well, that's a whole nother chapter, isn't it?
Yes,
well,
that's right.
Of it.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, that's right.
So you were up there building the roads in total for how long were you up there?
About 10 months.
10 months.
Yeah. Once we got to the end of our section, that wasn't the finish. We turned around and came back to widen the road, to make the final finish. We didn't go right into Katherine.
We
finished it at Burdham.
Burdham,
yeah. Which was the terminus for the old railway. We formed a convoy to return south. The government decided that I was getting close to being called up. So I thought to myself, well, I don't want to be going in the army, thank you. So I went and volunteered to go in the Air Force. And in the meantime, the call-up came from the army for me. And what happened? I got the mumps. And anyway, the certificate went in, and in the meantime, the call-up in between that time, being sick and everything, the call-up came for the Air Force. So I just went down, volunteered on North Terrace. I would have been just 19, to between 19 and 20, I think. It was a bit exciting. I had my second eldest brother was joining the Air Force too, around about the same time. And the photo of him and me over there, the small photo there, that's him alongside them. He's about 10 years older than me there. But he only spent about 12 months in the Air Force because he got out on the compassionate grounds. His wife got something shadow on the lung or something or other. Incidentally, she went on to die at 96. So so he could have stopped there. But brother was 94 when he died. Well, first of all, came here to Adelaide and spent 3 days at Scots College. That was the embarkation depot. And I was there for 3 days and posted up to 11 Signals Unit, which was at Kamali Creek on the main road, which wasn't very far from the Beaufighter Strip. It was just nearby, and the hospital was nearby. And the Japs used to come over and misfire and hit the hospital now and again. I was there for 16 months. I was 11 Signals for 7.5 months. Then I got posted to Nullumboy, which is Gove, where the bauxite. You've heard the bauxite mine? Well, I was there for 8.5 months. And Gove was named after an American pilot that was shot down near there. The daily routine was you used to go to the transport headquarters, which was at the unit. There was various jobs, but one occasion I can remember. This occasion was pretty important to me. I was detailed to go to a place called Cox Peninsula, which was straight across the bay from Darwin. I was detailed to go out there with this carpenter, Toddy, Corporal Todd, wonderful fellow, wonderful person. It turned out that we had to build this circular building.
So it's communication equipment?
Yeah, that's right. Technical stuff. Unfortunately, I damaged my finger. And anyway, got another driver out there to take my place. And anyway, the job they gave me was light duties. And I had to swear on the Bible this work that I had to do was the little building in the 11 Signals, S&C Publications, Secret and Confidential Publications. Another chap and I were organised to take two 410 motors down to a place out from Catherine called Mambaloo. It was an American Liberator bomber unit. There were people running here this way, running that way, and we looked at each other and said, "What's going on here?" Anyway, we stopped and we asked somebody, "Oh, there's been the Jap reconnaissance plane been shot down. It's been shot down out there. We're going to have a look." So we dumped the vehicle and climbed aboard and went out and saw this, where the Jap had gone straight in like that. It was burnt bodies and everything. And we had to unload the boats when they came in, you know. It was at Melville Bay, one of the bays, which was 18 miles from the camp. If the tide was out, or rather, if the tide was in and you went out 10 feet, if you walked out 10 feet, you'd be over your head 10 feet of water in 10 foot. I came over by boat because I was a bit scared of flying. And I was on the Dilga, SS Dilga, and it was supported by a Corvette, Air Force, Navy Corvette. And they always travel like that, zigzag. No straight course. There was one part there, the Arafura Sea. It is rather difficult to navigate in the darkness, so they anchored for a certain time for this section. This couple of others, fellas and myself, we were camped on top of the hold, which was to hold a lot of the bitumen for the new strip at Gove, and bombs underneath, which didn't make me feel very happy when I found out about it afterwards. But while we were there, all of a sudden the lights went on. Somebody, you know, mistook the light switch. And of course the chorus was, "Sweat those bloody lights out." Anyway, next morning we were away again. Whenever a boat came in over there, all hands on deck, Army, Air Force, Navy, what have you, all had to go and unload the boat because of the fear of being attacked by the Japs, whatever. I was told to go in the hold, and of course there was tar dripping everywhere. Incidentally, afterwards, to try and get the tar off, I did the worst thing in the world. It was to wash the tar off with the power kerosene. It gave me hell for 2 days. You know, it more or less burnt the skin too much with the mixture with the tar.
Sounds painful.
And it was painful. That's something I wanted to forget about. There's another story about the first boat that went over. It was loaded with beer. And the story and the rumour had it that the whole lot of the people on board the boat, that helped unload the boat, officers and everything, got the beer and played Mary Hill. And in fact, the rumour had it that one truckload of beer was pinched and taken out bush somewhere. On one occasion, it's my first meeting with the natives up there. A fellow I knew, as a matter of fact, I remembered his name. His name was Keith Saunders from Tasmania. He said, "What about we go for a walk one day?" So we went for a walk, and we came across these natives with all that they had on was loincloth. And Keith had a camera, which he wasn't supposed to have, but he used to take photos and develop them in the tent. And so we came across these natives, and with a little bit of apprehension on my part, because I wondered what reaction was going to take place. Sure. But there was roughly about six of them, and Keith wanted to get a photo of them, and he explained to them about taking a photo, and they all stood up, and they even made room for me to go in the photo too. Unfortunately, I lost the photo, which would have been very good to have. However, I didn't. And they were friendly, and they had their little whirlies along the beach, you know, so it was very primitive. And that was an experience in itself.
So what year did that happen?
Oh, that was in 1944.
Excellent. Yeah. That's a great little story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Keith and I walked around with our Tommy guns. Speaking of the Tommy guns, the field officer said to us, being drivers, "Oh, the 303 rifle's too cumbersome to have that in the cabin with you. Well, I'll issue Tommy guns for you." So that's how we come to get that. This field officer was unable to get together with the CO of the unit, because the CO and the unit didn't want bulldust. Understand that meaning? You could say worse. And all he wanted was work. He said, "I want work. I don't want all this other rubbish." And that's just by the way. Murchison, his name was. Squadron Leader Murchison. At Gove.
And how do you spell Gove? How do you spell that?
G-O-V-E. Now, getting to entertainment, on one occasion there was a group of, I think, about three girls with their orchestral accompaniment came over there to entertain, and they didn't have a drummer. So I put myself forward. I said, "I can rattle them a bit." And that was good. And but being outside, I don't know whether you've had the experience, you couldn't, the night air made them come loose all the time. Had to keep tightening it, the skin.
The tuning, yes.
Yeah. And however, well, I got through that all right.
And did you have the chance to rehearse? Did you have the opportunity to rehearse with the group?
No, not really. No, no, just...
By the seat of your pants?
Into it. I enjoyed that. But when the pilot came over with the girls, he was flying a DC-3, the Decatur plane, and he was showing off a bit. When he came in, he gave the girls a thrill, you know, down low on the aircraft and turned around and then landed. That was only for one night. One of the pilots from the Boomerang Squadron, Pilot Officer Ebb, but it was rather sad because 2 days after that he was killed in a plane crash patrolling. And Boomerang Squadron was, which I wasn't part of, of course, but I got to know them. The squadron leader was Chinese, Squadron Leader Goon. He was born in Australia, I think. Now, there's another story that the unit that did the strip, made the new strip at Gove, their time was finished. And they had to move out. So they had a boat arranged for them down at the anchorage at Melville Bay, which was about 18 miles from the camp, from our camp, and the strip. And the equipment was being loaded onto the ship, but one of the Caterpillar tractors was badly positioned on the barge to go out to the plane, you know, to take it off the barge and into the ship, and it slipped. This tractor slipped off the thing into the water, into about 15 foot of water, which was only far from here to the bathroom. Finished up, someone to get down and put the hitch onto the tractor so they could take it, pull it away. And there were about 10 vehicles, such as four-wheel drive trucks and tractors, goodness knows what, hooked on one onto the other to try and pull this tractor from the water. And the captain of the ship said, "If you don't get it on by midnight, I'm not waiting to get it. You can leave it there because I've got a sail, you see." And he didn't get it.
They couldn't get it out.
They left it there. But I understand afterwards. I didn't witness it, but. I believe they got it out somehow. I'm not sure how. But that was quite an experience.
Where were you when you heard the news?
At the end of the war?
That the war was over. Where were you when you heard the news?
I was in Rundle Street in Adelaide when they were taking photos galore, crowd and so forth. That my last six, then after that, I wasn't discharged until about 6 months afterwards.
Okay.
And I was at Port Pirie. I was posted up there to help clear the the decks, as it were, you know, of the unit, clearing out, taking out bombs, practice bombs, and all manner of things, loading them on the trucks and on the railway. And the story was that they were taken out to sea and dropped in the sea, you know, get rid of them.
So there's a lot of, what's the word? So there's a lot of, not wreckage, there's a lot of debris up there in the Gulf.
A lot of debris?
Debris of war debris up there in the Gulf.
Well, I'm not sure really about that. No, I don't think there was much in the Gulf.
Okay, sorry.
To my knowledge.
So you spent roughly 6 months up at Port Perry?
Yes, I was discharged. I got notice of my discharge up there. Then I was brought. I had to go to opposite to the military hospital on Dawes Road. The unit was there in the paddocks, four PD personnel depot, and that's where I got discharged from.
At this point in time, did you have a plan? Did you have an idea of what you wanted to pursue now that you were discharged?
Not really. I was just so glad to get out of the and the civilian life again. But that came afterwards. I got into the earth moving business and worked in the council down there, and then I bought my own truck. It bought a new 5-ton Ford tipper, and had to wait 6 weeks for the steel because it was so scarce. My truck, my brother Colin, he was also on the highways, and I was up at Loxton working on the roads between Loxton and Marook and Loxton and Berry, and doing roads for the soldier settlement. Loads in around Loxton, and played in the band for a couple of years.
This is Loxton, was it?
Yeah.
What was the group?
Yeah, the Merrymakers. At drive doing up to 150 to 200 miles a day on contract carting, and going out and playing in this orchestra, which was saxophone, trumpet and piano. I'm afraid it was too much. I had to give it away. It was out at 3 o'clock in the morning and all that.
Having a good time?
Going at various places to play for dancers.
That must have been a great period though for you. Because
it was, yeah, it was a great period. I never regretted it, but I used to have a lot of recordings, you know, gramophone records, 2 and 6 months they were, 2 cities and 6 months. I had quite a lot of fun with those. Had to pick up my eldest brother, who was into the mechanical side of things, and he rigged up a pickup, you know, off the radio to put it through the loudspeakers.
Terrific.
That was good too.
So, Working the roads during the day and then playing in the orchestra at night became too much.
Yeah, it did.
So the orchestra...
I was coming down to Kemmerdijk, my wife-to-be, and I used to go and play cards with the people in the local store, and I was nearly going to sleep all the time.
Those early days of courting?
Yeah, well, she was in a one-teacher school at Kemmerdijk. It was only about 10 or a dozen. And I was then introduced to her in the local store. I'll never forget it, the one particular day. And
so your wife's name is Viola?
Yeah, that's right.
Where did you get married?
At Broadview. She was a great church person, had six children, and the money supply was a bit short. She taught on the reserve, you know, when they wanted teachers to come in for a couple of days. We had a house built at Kemmerdijk. Whilst we had that house, we could not buy a house through the housing trust. When we sold it, the one in the country, then we could buy a housing trust house. In the meantime, I had to pay rent. That's how we got the house. But I knew somebody in the housing trust. It was her brother used to work in there.
So.
And I had 24 and a half years in the housing trust. Started off as a bulldozer driver. Got to be a caterpillar grader operator, which I operate for 9.5 years, getting ready for bitumen. With a tolerance of that much, that's all. You know, you had to be
spot on, that
close to being perfect. Did that allow that much? But that's only just by the way.
Did you have a favourite?
Hmm?
Did you have a favourite vehicle over the years to operate?
Yes, I had this. Yeah.
What was your favourite?
Cat 12, Caterpillar 12 grader, the big grader. Getting
any monies were getting tighter.
And I went home and I said to my wife about it. She said, "What'd you tell him? Tell him you'd take the job?" So I said, "No, I didn't." I said, "I'd think about it." Anyway, I went back and told him, and I had to go in for an interview for that too, but that was foregone concluded. And I was there for 6 years in the office.
Did you enjoy the change?
I did. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the whole gambit, the whole setup of the housing trust.
Did you do any travelling when you retired?
Oh yes, your wife and I availed ourselves of the free pass to Broken Hill on the train. We got a free pass every year. We went to Sydney one time. I had been there with my mother and father when I was a boy, Sydney on a trip.
What year, can you tell me what year that was, roughly?
About 1938, yeah.
Must have changed quite a lot from what you remember.
Yeah, it changed, there's no doubt.
So when you retired in 1987, whereabouts were you living?
We were living at Mitchell Park. My wife, Morris, said one day, "Well, I think perhaps you better give it away because you're driving people around your own age." I did.
So what age were you when you stopped driving?
Oh, I was about 80, I think, 82 or 3, something like that.
Was that a difficult day?
Oh, what, stopping?
Stopping, to stopping?
Oh, no, I was prepared to do that. I mean, I could see the point in it, but I enjoyed it while I was doing it.
What age are you now, Clem?
Now?
Today.
98.
98?
Yes.
Sorry, just doing a quick math there.
24th okay. of March, I'll be 99.
You feeling pretty good?
I'm feeling pretty good, yeah.
Excellent.
I don't feel any problem at all, really.
Currently 98 years of age, Clem. What would you say have been some of the most memorable milestones in your lifetime?
I think possibly that the most memorable moments would have been when I was up at in Arnhem Land, Melville Bay, and up that part, because I enjoyed that part of my life. I found it better weather than Darwin. Darwin was pretty miserable, pretty sticky. Yeah, I mean I've met many, I suppose, highlights in my life. I'd have to stop and really think about it, but
it's a difficult question, I imagine.
And I like my working life here in Adelaide. That was a great experience as far as I'm concerned. How I started as just a very small way by driving a small bulldozer and then gradually getting up to being a clerk in the office in town. That was good too. And of course, during my lifetime, playing goal bowls was good.
Which club did you play for?
Mitcham AFA branch, bowls. There's nothing there now. Just closed up in 2011. You may not know it there. It's behind the Shell service station on Blair Road.
What's happening in this photograph here?
That's me being received, getting the OAM.
How did you feel that day?
Very, very pumped up. When I first got notified about it, well, I was overwhelmed, it was the word, because I just carried on with all this, not realising that I might be getting something like this. I believe it takes a few people to recommend you, but there's a bit of a hush-hush about that. You don't find that out.
So you don't know who put you forward?
No.
Wow.
I've got a fair idea, of course, who the people were.
Mm. What year did you receive the OAM?
2018, I think it was.
What advice could you give to future generations about life?
Well,
what do you think's important?
Have a good, clean living. I'm really dead against smoking. That's one thing. And the overindulgence of liquor.
Clem McArdle, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me and to share some stories and experiences. It's been an absolute pleasure to sit here with you and to hear those. Thank you so much.
That's all right. I'm glad you enjoyed doing it. And I've enjoyed doing it too.
If you or someone you know would like to be captured in a podcast, contact Christian Teusner via this email address, theemutree@gmail.com. emutree@gmail.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening.